Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the domestic debate over Iraq is dominating the headlines, usually characterized as a showdown between Congress and the White House over Democratic calls to withdraw U.S. troops. The stalemate leaves many reporters asking the question, what's next? But in the midst of the partisan scrum on Capitol Hill, what's actually happening in Iraq? Freelance journalist David Enders will join us to share his thoughts. Also this week, the genocide by Turks against Armenians in 1915 is still making news. A dispute erupted recently in the Los Angeles Times when managing editor Doug France spiked a report by veteran Times reporter Mark Arax. Claiming Arax had a conflict of interest, France killed the Armenian-American journalist's report about pending congressional legislation that officially designates the 1915 massacres of Armenians as genocide. Harut Sasunian, the publisher of the California Courier, an Armenian-American newspaper on the West Coast, will join us with the latest on that. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's news.
The Democratic presidential candidates met for their first debate on April 26th, and the post-debate analysis was, as it's prone to be, rather shallow. But many pundits and reporters were worked up about one thing. There were too many candidates. And what they meant by that was pretty simple. Congressman Dennis Kucinich and former Senator Mike Gravel were getting in the way. The Washington Post reported that six of the candidates, quote, showed themselves to be both substantive and direct in their responses, close quote. Kucinich and Gravel, then, were indirect and lacking substance. The LA Times tried to use polling data to exclude these left-leaning candidates, noting their negligible showing in polls. Well, at this point, the polls are almost meaningless, but it's worth noting that Kucinich and Gravel are essentially tied with some of the other Democratic contenders, like Senators Joe Biden and Chris Dodd and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson. Some media figures were more direct. CBS host Bob Schieffer said the presence of the lesser candidates just wastes time, while ABC host George Stephanopoulos dubbed Gravel comic relief. MSNBC's Chris Matthews gave a perhaps inadvertently revealing glimpse into how these pundits think when he asked an advisor to Barack Obama whether his candidate was hampered by the fact that you had a radical critique coming from Gravel and Kucinich. Their presence, to Matthews, made Obama seem middle of the road politically. It was a reminder that the ideas expressed by Kucinich and Gravel, even when they represent the feelings of millions of Americans, are rarely included in the political debate presented by the corporate media. And when they do sneak into that debate, well, journalists aren't too happy about it.
Lessons from the Vietnam War is something mainstream media commentators are fond of teaching us these days, which is sort of funny considering that it wasn't that long ago that many of the same commentators insisted that comparisons of Iraq and Vietnam were silly. The latest such lesson comes to us from ABC White House correspondent Terry Moran on April 26, when he explained that in the current debate over Iraq, opposing the war could be hazardous for Democrats. Quote, the shadow of the Vietnam War looms over this debate. Beginning in the late 1960s, Democrats, reflecting public opinion, opposed that war and lost 7 of the next 10 presidential elections, close quote. Well, like many other such mainstream lessons, Moran mangles the history. First of all, before 1973, when for most practical purposes the Vietnam War ended for the U.S., both political parties and the White House were working to withdraw U.S. troops. And the next presidential election after that, in 1976, was won by a Democrat. Furthermore, the Democratic majorities in both houses grew stronger in both 1974 and 1976, the two elections following the U.S. stand-down. So unless Moran is saying that the political cost to the Democrats of opposing the Vietnam War grew stronger as time went on, and the eventual opposition of Republicans to the war incurred no penalty, then Moran's math is just wrong. But there's something even more silly about Moran's logic. By the early 1970s, as today, solid majorities of the American people favored withdrawal. By cautioning Democrats against withdrawal lest they incur the wrath of the American people, Moran seems to be saying the last thing the American people want is politicians who will do what the American people want.
It's early in the 2008 campaign cycle, for sure, but U.S. News and World Report is already on the lookout for flip-flopping. In the magazine's April 30th issue, reporter Kenneth Walsh sizes up the chameleon candidates. And in keeping with a certain lamentable media technique, the piece is perfectly balanced. Three Republicans are profiled, along with three Democrats. which suggests that the flip-flopping is spread around more or less equally. But the evidence suggests otherwise. Rudy Giuliani's record on abortion rights, John McCain's cozying up to right-wing Christians he once despised, and Mitt Romney's inconsistency about any number of issues is amply documented by the magazine, and these things are obvious to anyone who's paying attention. On the Democratic side, however, Walsh's false balance model falls apart. Hillary Clinton is, quote, trying to reintroduce herself to the public as a warmer, more engaging, less threatening personality, close quote. She is also trying, quote, to demonstrate her commitment to national security, close quote. The sole example is that she's not repudiated her Iraq vote, which is an odd example to use to prove that someone is a flip-flopper. Barack Obama's rise has been meteoric, we learn, and people aren't sure he's got enough experience. Again, not sure how that's a flip-flop. And John Edwards, well, he was a sunny optimist in 2004 who, quote, called for reducing the disparities between rich and poor, close quote. And now? Well, U.S. News tells us he's running from the left. It's hard not to miss the point here. No matter what the evidence, Democrats are always going to be guilty of just as much or maybe even a little more flip-flopping than their Republican counterparts.
Well, leading off an April 26th report on Iran's nuclear program, CBS anchor Katie Couric announced, quote, "There's a new urgency tonight about the nuclear threat in Iran. In the latest assessment, U.S. intelligence is now saying it believes Iran may be able to build a nuclear weapon in just a few years. That is sooner than anyone expected," close quote. Well, first off, suggesting there's a threat in Iran takes the Bush White House position at face value and ignores Iran's protests that they are only developing a nuclear energy program. But about the second part of Couric's claim, that Iran could develop nuclear weapons sooner than U.S. intelligence officials previously thought, here's what CBS reporter David Martin said in the report following Couric's sensational headline. Quote, U.S. intelligence officials cautioned that before Iran could meet or beat the 2010 date, it would have to make further technical progress in operating this uranium enrichment plant now under construction. As a result, there is no change in the official estimate it will take Iran until 2015 to become a nuclear power, close quote. So, U.S. intelligence officials do not say what Couric said they said. Couric says the Iran threat is increasing, citing U.S. intelligence. U.S. intelligence says that it isn't. Couple this with the fact that U.S. intelligence admits that its information from inside Iran is weak and Iran's claims that it is uninterested in nuclear weapons, and you've got Couric touting an Iran threat that might be non-existent. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? It makes one wonder if it really is true that you can't teach an old dog new tricks.
Well, maybe you can. When Congressman Dennis Kucinich announced his intention to impeach Vice President Dick Cheney, he didn't exactly make waves in the mainstream media. The Washington Post's Dana Milbank turned in a column mocking the press conference, and here's a new one, poked fun at Kucinich's hair. But Milbank's Post colleague Richard Cohen had a surprisingly different take, writing on May 2nd that while Kucinich doesn't stand a chance at actually impeaching Cheney, he deserves credit for putting forth a well-documented case. Cohen wrote, quote, "He is onto something here. It is easy enough to ad hominize him to the margins, you know, the skinny guy among the real presidential candidates. But at a given moment, and this is one, he's the only one on that stage who articulates a genuine sense of betrayal." Close quote. Well, when Cohen refers to how easy it is to ad hominize Kucinich, he's speaking from experience, though he doesn't acknowledge it. Cohen devoted much of a column in February of 2003 that was headlined Anti-War and Illogical to attacking Kucinich. Cohen cheered on Pentagon advisor Richard Perle for calling Kucinich a liar, a TV moment Cohen found particularly shocking, not to mention refreshing. Cohen went on to ask, quote, "How did this fool get on Meet the Press?" Close quote. He wasn't referring to Perle, in case you were wondering. Cohen also called Kucinich an indomitable demagogue and quipped that he, quote, "must have studied logic in France," close quote, which was apparently intended as an insult. Perhaps it's a sign of media progress that someone like Cohen, who delighted in smearing Kucinich 4 years ago, has changed his tune. A better question is why it took 4 years for a pundit like Cohen to take critics of this White House like Kucinich seriously.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group Fair. Fair also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. Mm-hmm.
The battle over continued funding for the Iraq War continues to dominate political and media chatter, what with Bush's veto and the Democrats debating over what to do next. Lost amidst all of this is, well, Iraq, where violence continues to rage as the White House's so-called surge plan takes effect in and around Baghdad. But political maneuvering is happening inside Iraq that could be just as important as the action on Capitol Hill. So what's going on in Iraq, and how are these events being interpreted by the mainstream media here in the United States? Joining us to share his thoughts is David Enders. He's a freelance journalist and author of the book Baghdad Bulletin. David Enders, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
When we read about Iraqi politics in the U.S. media, it's often about Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite cleric who wields significant power in Iraqi politics, not to mention leading a sizable armed force that has battled U.S. troops. The most recent news was his decision late last month to pull cabinet ministers out of the Iraqi government. It led the New York Times to write of al-Sadr that he has, quote, become a great improviser, the Miles Davis of the war, close quote. It would seem to suggest, that kind of writing, that for some in the U.S. media, 4 years into this war now, Iraqi politics are still hard to figure out.
Yeah, certainly. And I think it's kind of strange that we can't just say that al-Sadr is capable of, you know, throwing the U.S. an occasional curveball. I think throughout the war, and especially at the beginning, there's always been an effort, certainly on the part of the American administration and the military and you know, the embassy in Baghdad or the CPA to downplay al-Sadr's power and his influence. And then I think that's extended to the American press in great part, partially because initially people tended to spend a lot of time in the green zone, tended to spend time with Iraqis who spoke English, who had maybe been educated abroad and were sympathetic to the American project in the country. I was having dinner, I think it was 2004, 2005, right around the time of the elections, with a writer for Time, and I'll never forget this. He looks at me and says, Muqtada al-Sadr will never succeed in Iraqi politics because he's willing to use violence. And I kind of looked at this guy and about dropped my fork and, you know, was amazed that anyone who had spent months in Iraq could make such a statement, especially at a time when, you know, violence seemed to be the driving political force. And certainly I think he's kind of eaten his words at this point. But my sense from, I had a lot of arguments with other journalists in Baghdad about the power he had and his ability to influence what was happening. People really didn't believe it. And I think in part it's because Iraq is not covered as Iraq. It's not just the administration that downplays the situation. It's the media coverage, because people don't go to Sadr City, or when they write about Sadr City, they use this line, the clerics, the fiery clerics stronghold, or something like that. Mm-hmm. They don't point out that if it's between 2 and 3 million people, so depending on your estimate, that's a third to half the population of Baghdad. We're talking about huge numbers of people who aren't seen by our media, who aren't generally quoted by our media, who aren't given a voice, whereas, you know, they now he has a bit of that in the parliament, but, you know, out in the streets, American reporters often don't get out in the streets.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose that you could make the argument that instead of being an improviser, he's been relatively consistent. I was thinking about this watching this CNN report on May 1st that argued against withdrawing U.S. troops. The anchor said, quote, some U.S. troops and Iraqi officials warn an early American exit could leave the country in worse shape than it is now, close quote. CNN, of course, managed to speak only to Americans and Iraqis who take that view. We've noted here countless times that Iraqis, when they're polled, tell pollsters that they want U.S. troops out of their country. This is certainly in keeping with what someone like al-Sadr is advocating for. It would seem like if you can't acknowledge that base fact, then much of what happens in Iraq, politically speaking, whether it's al-Sadr or anyone else, doesn't make sense to you because it's coming from nowhere.
Yeah, and another thing Iraqis say when they're polled is that 60%, I think one poll I saw, 60 to 70% said they didn't want a democracy. They wanted a dictatorship or a religiously led government. For most Iraqis, democracy is now equal to chaos, to terror, to what the occupation has brought. And I just think Iraq has not been covered as a country that's between Saudi Arabia and Iran.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the lines you hear frequently from pundits and politicians, including many prominent Democrats, is that the Iraqis themselves haven't stepped up to stop the violence. You wrote an article for The Nation magazine back in January that was in part about the difficulties in making something like that happen, that bolstering certain Iraqi security forces, as many U.S. politicians and pundits are calling for, can actually make the sectarian violence worse.
Well, it has. We've armed one side of a civil war. There's no doubt about that. The Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, we've trained their security forces, we've armed them, and they've carried out sectarian attacks. We've armed them in part to take out Sadr's militia. And what Sadr's militia did, in large part, why they're popular is people say that they're the only people providing protection. Young men go out in the streets, pick up guns to guard their neighborhoods and prevent the kind of suicide bombings that George Bush points to. The very reason we need to be in Iraq. And then at the same time, they do this and then they end up fighting with American troops. Who say that they can't have guns. So Iraqis, Sadr in particular, is between a rock and a hard place. Do you risk confrontation with the Americans while trying to protect? And certainly there were some militia units that went on the offensive as well. But primarily, people supported the presence of the militia as a defensive mechanism. And in Sadr City, it worked for the most part. It made Sadr City, for a time, virtually the safest place in Baghdad. And Iraqis see this, and who do you expect them to side with?
Now, you've spent significant time in Iraq. What are you seeing now media-wise that you think is way off the mark? We know reporters are almost unable to move around the country, even given their limited means to travel around and report. What occurs to you when you read the paper, watch television news, that makes you think we're missing the story here?
The refugees. And there has been coverage, but I don't think there's been enough. And I don't think that the issue I mentioned earlier, that the ethnic cleansing began long before the destruction of the shrine in Samarra, which is what most people are familiar with, is sort of the starting point for the civil war. There are a million Iraqis in Syria, almost that many in Jordan, and some 2 million IDPs, internally displaced persons, is how the UN refers to them, who are essentially refugees inside the country and can't leave for the most part. And also, I don't think we get the sense that Iraqis, if they can, would leave for the most part. Most people have given up. For some reason, the coverage still seems to give the benefit of the doubt to the administration and to ideas like a troop surge, when at every point we've seen the violence increase as the U.S. presence and the number of U.S. operations has increased. The violence itself has increased. And I think that it's extremely unfair to the people there that our coverage somehow defines objectivity as giving the benefit of the doubt to something that would by all other measures have already failed. If you were running a business, you wouldn't run it like this.
We've been speaking with David Enders. He's a freelance journalist and author of the book Baghdad Bulletin. David Enders, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
A dispute over reporting about the 1915 Turkish genocide against Armenians has touched off a battle within the Los Angeles Times. The battle pits veteran Times reporter Mark Arax against the paper's managing editor, Douglas France. At issue is a mid-April report written by Arax, an Armenian-American, about a pending congressional resolution that would call the 1915 Armenian massacres genocide. Arax's story was spiked by editor France, who claimed that Arax had a conflict of interest. Joining us now to explain the story further is Harut Sasunian. He is the publisher of the California Courier, an American-Armenian newspaper based in Los Angeles. Harut Sasunian, welcome to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with the dispute. Reporter Mark Arax wrote a story about the congressional legislation about the Armenian genocide, and editor Doug France killed the story, saying Arax had a conflict. Then Arax made countercharges against France of discrimination. Harut Sasunian, what did France say was the basis for his charge that Arax had a conflict?
He used two arguments. The first is that he, according to him, Mark Arax had signed a petition a couple of years ago reminding the editors of the Los Angeles Times about the paper's own policy of calling the Armenian genocide a genocide. And the second accusation was that he had gone around the chain of command in submitting his article for publication.
Well, tell us a little bit about that so-called petition. Arax says the petition was really just an internal letter co-signed with other reporters calling on the L.A. Times to follow its own style rules and call the Armenian genocide a genocide. Isn't that right?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, since the controversy broke, the L.A. Times has conducted an internal investigation and have proven that the petition was not a petition at all. It was a very proper letter bringing to the editor's attention that they have deviated from their own policy. And in fact, the LA Times has a code of ethics that requires its staff to bring to the attention of the management any mistakes or deviation from policy by the paper.
Now, France was alleging that by signing this petition, what France called a petition, that Arax was sort of going on the record and then he was therefore invested in the story and therefore was incapable of objectively or professionally reporting on that story.
Yes. In fact, Mark Arax has worked at the Times for more than 20 years. He's written hundreds of articles over the years. Not one of them have been questioned by anyone until Douglas France did arrive from Istanbul to his new job and start raising this red herring of personal bias, whereas no such charge was ever raised. In fact, France himself, when he saw Mark Arax's article that was ready to be put on the front page several weeks ago, he said it was well-written, well-reported, did not raise any objection in terms of the content of the article.
So there was nothing inaccurate or imbalanced in the Arax report in Doug France's own opinion. So in the absence of evidence, it might appear that France objected to Arax reporting on the subject simply because he's of Armenian descent and took issue with the fact that the paper had actually issued qualifiers against its own style rules. It had issued qualifiers calling into question whether the genocide was actually a genocide, saying things like the massacres which Armenians claim were a genocide.
Correct. So it was a very proper action, and it appears to me that Douglas France was using that letter as an excuse to kill a story which, for whatever reason, rather than the bias being on the part of Mark Arax, it looks like Douglas France himself has a bias based on his own background.
You've already touched on that. You said that France came to the L.A. Times. He used to be a reporter for the New York Times. He came to the L.A. Times from Istanbul. And as the story has unfolded with many other Times staffers and Southern California Jewish community groups siding with the reporter, it has emerged, as you mentioned, that there may be evidence that France harbors his own biases or conflicts. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, you know, we can't read his heart, but there are some indications that there's something that's off here. When he worked for the New York Times, he was the Istanbul bureau chief for the New York Times. Then he switched to LA Times and stayed in Istanbul, reporting from Istanbul for the LA Times. And then when he came over here, he turned down all invitations to meet with our Armenian community leadership, saying that there's no reason to meet. And I have direct reports that the Consul General of Turkey in Los Angeles has said that Douglas France is a good friend, and whenever he has a problem with the Times, he calls France, and he takes care of his problems with the paper. And finally, we just discovered that France is going to Istanbul in 2 weeks to moderate a panel on the panel's called Sharing the Democratic Experience, apparently to show what a democratic country Turkey is. And on the panel is a notorious denialist of the Armenian genocide by the name of Andrew Mango. This will be the equivalent of a top editor sitting on a panel with David Irving, the infamous Holocaust revisionist.
Well, one factor in reporting in the U.S. about the Armenian genocide is that Turkey is an American ally and actively lobbies against calling the 1915 massacres genocide. If our media outlets were more independent of the government, this might be less of a problem. But Harut Sasunian, what would you hope journalists reporting on, say, the congressional resolution about the Armenian genocide would convey to their readers and viewers?
I think journalists should do what their job requires them to do, which is tell the facts as they are, regardless of any political consideration. They are not politicians, they're not paid, they're not hired to put a political spin on stories. They report the facts as they see them. And the facts of the Armenian genocide are plain. The LA Times has a policy saying genocide, genocide, so does the New York Times, so does Time Magazine and various other. So if they only report the facts and leave the political considerations to the politicians, we'll all be better off.
And finally, Harut Sasunian, you're the publisher of the California Courier. What is your paper calling for with regard to the internal dispute at the
Los Angeles Times? I've written two columns so far, and the first column called for the dismissal of Douglas France from this position as managing editor. Obviously, he has created a hostile environment in the newsroom, and it is difficult to imagine how the reporters, Mark Arax and the rest of the reporters, can coexist under such biased management by Douglas France.
We've been speaking with Harut Sasunian, the publisher of the California Courier, an English-language Armenian-American newspaper based in Los Angeles. Harut Sasunian, thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thank you for the invitation.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. Again, that's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.